wishing you a very good weekend.
Today is Friday, October the 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour. After months of talks, President Biden says there's finally a deal with congressional Democrats on his sweeping domestic policy package.
And when paired with the bipartisan infrastructure, we'll truly transform this nation.
And President Biden is calling on Sudan's military leaders to release detainees immediately and restore institutions of transitional government. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that he spoke with deposed Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, who was released from custody on Tuesday.
An immediate release of all political actors detained in connection with these events. A full restoration of the civilian-led transitional government.
And children will be keynote speakers at a meeting in Australia that aims at reinvigorating outdoor play to help tackle an epidemic of social isolation and loneliness. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, after months of talks, President Biden says there's finally a deal with congressional Democrats on his sweeping domestic policy package. AP's Washington correspondent Saga Megani reports.
I know we have a historic economic framework.
The president bills it as a package that'll fundamentally improve millions of lives, $1.75 trillion in social services and climate change programs. But it's dramatically scaled back from what he wanted. Officials say things like paid family leave are not included.
But that's what compromise is.
Amid disagreements among various blocs of Democrats, the president went to the Capitol this morning to lobby them hours before leaving for Europe. One source says he told them what happens in the next week will determine the fate of his presidency. Sagar Magani, Washington.
President Joe Biden left late Thursday to attend the G20 Leaders Summit in Rome and then continues to the United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP26, in Glasgow, Scotland. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakuswara, who is traveling with the president, has this report on the key issues that leaders will discuss.
Preparations are underway in Rome, where G20 Leaders Summit will be held. With Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin not attending in person, an opportunity for U.S. President Joe Biden, said National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan earlier this week.
The U.S. and Europe will be there, and they'll be there energized and united at both the G20 and COP26, driving the agenda.
But it won't be easy. Biden must repair U.S. credibility following the messy military withdrawal from Afghanistan and rift with Paris over the AUKUS deal that scuttled a French submarine contract with Australia. Leslie Benjamori, director of the U.S. and the Americas program at Chatham House, via Skype.
It is about rebuilding the transatlantic partnership after a very difficult August with the exit from Afghanistan and the European reaction to that. But it is then about concrete issues. So climate, the global minimum corporate tax agreement, and then debt restructuring is really important.
Biden will emphasize his pledge to cut greenhouse gas emissions to about 50% below 2005 levels by 2030. But U.S. global leadership on the issue also depends on Biden's domestic climate agenda in his infrastructure and social spending bills currently struggling in Congress. Matthew Goodman, Senior Vice President for Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said via Skype.
The president, unfortunately, is not going to be in the same strong position he would have been to push other countries to make further, more ambitious commitments on climate.
Phasing out coal is a key contention, as is the pledge by rich nations to provide $100 billion a year in climate financing to help developing countries reduce emissions and mitigate the impacts of climate change. Chinese Vice Minister of Ecology and Environment, Ye Min.
In the context of the official implementation of the Paris Agreement, these issues will affect political mutual trust and the ability of developing countries to take climate-related actions.
On the pandemic front, humanitarian organizations say wealthy countries failed to fulfill pledges made at last year's G20 to ensure global vaccine access, instead hoarding hundreds of millions of doses for their own populations. Natalie Arnoux, head of regional advocacy at Médecins Sans Frontières Access Campaign via Skype.
What we would like to see is them to clearly set up a schedule to provide these doses to COVAX for the countries in a transparent way with a very clear timetable.
Biden, a devout Catholic, will meet with Pope Francis at the Vatican on Friday prior to the G20 and COP26. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
After a military takeover of the Sudanese government, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with deposed Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok, who was released from custody earlier this week. The U.S. is calling for a return to the civilian-led transition to democracy, as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
As pro-civilian government protesters in Sudan's capital blocked traffic with small brick barricades, the international community was swift to condemn this week's military takeover in Sudan. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
I once again strongly condemned the forceful military takeover of power in Sudan. And I urge, of course, all stakeholders to exercise maximum restraint.
The U.S. Deputy Representative to the United Nations, Richard Mills Jr.
We have said repeatedly, any changes to the transitional government by force in Khartoum puts at risk U.S. assistance.
Sudan's leading general, Abdel Fattah Burhan, said he was dissolving the country's ruling sovereign council, as well as the government led by Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, in an effort, in his words, to preserve the path of the magnificent December Revolution until its final goals are achieved. But in Washington, State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the Sudanese military has subverted the democratic aspirations of the Sudanese people. He outlined U.S. goals in this situation, working with the international community.
An immediate release of all political actors detained in connection with these events, a full restoration of the civilian-led transitional government, and a refraining from any violence against peaceful protesters, including the use of live ammunition. And we strongly condemn recent reports of violence against peaceful protesters.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken called Prime Minister Hamdok late Tuesday, welcomed his release from custody, and emphasized U.S. support for the civilian-led transition to democracy. Diplomatic outreach in the region is exactly what is needed right now, Joseph Tucker of the U.S. Institute of Peace told VOA.
I hope there's engagement with Egypt because that's the crux of the matter, is that the military and those aligned with the military feel, again, whether explicit or not, that they do have the backing of the region. So that high-level U.S. government attention is critical.
The State Department has called on the Sudanese military to refrain from any violence against peaceful protesters, which includes not using live ammunition. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Many states have reported sharp declines in the number of COVID-19 cases, but some health officials are warning another increase is in sight. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
California's governor getting a publicly viewed booster shot.
Let's not put our guard down. Let's get those booster shots.
They're at a plateau, but models predict coronavirus hospitalizations will increase slightly over the next month, and some 3,000 more deaths could occur in California by Thanksgiving week. There are concerns, too, in New Mexico, where state health officials say they've hit a plateau when it comes to COVID cases declining, even though 72% of people in the state are vaccinated. Health officials say booster shots are really key because the immunity sparked by the earlier vaccinations does appear to be waning. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Children are the keynote speakers at a meeting in Australia that started Thursday, aimed at reinvigorating outdoor play to help tackle an epidemic of social isolation and loneliness. From Sydney, Phil Massa reports.
Informal outdoor play has been declining in Australia. Academics say Australian parents have become increasingly cautious and worried about the safety and well-being of their children. Experts say there are a range of factors contributing to the decline in outdoor play, including increased traffic, a lack of city planning, and greater housing density. Stay-at-home orders during COVID-19 lockdowns have exacerbated the issue. But parents also fear abductions by strangers, although officials say such incidents are incredibly rare. In Western Australia alone, there were 15 kidnapping and child-stealing incidents reported in the past year, according to official government figures. The summit is aiming to address such issues with an all-inclusive platform, including children's participation. Nicole Schwier's 11-year-old daughter is one of the keynote speakers at the Childhood Summit. Schwier refuses to allow her children to play in the streets outside.
You hear of kids 11 and younger just being snatched, and it's not that I don't trust my neighbours, we know our neighbours great, but I don't trust my neighbourhood anymore, and that's a big problem.
Academics say a lack of outdoor play is robbing children of vital social skills they'll need as adults. Those attending the Childhood Summit in Brisbane will hear of the potential physical and mental consequences. Ayano Moser, one of the organisers of the conference, says a lack of play is leaving some children dangerously isolated.
We're seeing the highest rate of youth suicide that we've ever seen. That is largely to do with the fact that children have been disconnected from each other. They haven't built up those social skills to cope with social settings, and social isolation and loneliness is such an epidemic. You know, I've heard it earmarked as the next biggest health crisis.
Medium and high density housing, which is relatively new in Australia, is presenting new challenges. In Sydney, almost a quarter of households in apartments are families with children. Experts are warning that their needs are not being met. They say developers should put the well-being of children first, with carefully designed parks, playgrounds, and safer streets. They say they believe play is the work of childhood, which creates resilient and healthy adults. The three-day conference brings together children, teachers, architects, urban planners, and academics. The aim is to forge so-called play action plans for towns and cities across Australia and beyond. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The World Health Organization warns a shortage of syringes is threatening to upend efforts to vaccinate millions of Africans against COVID-19, a disease that has infected more than 8.4 million people on the continent, killing 217,000 people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Life-saving vaccines are in short supply in Africa. The World Health Organization says only 6% of Africa's 1.2 billion people are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus. That compares with more than 40% of the people in most high-income countries. Vaccine shipments to the continent are ramping up and expected to increase into next year. While that is encouraging, WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says a scarcity of syringes could paralyze progress.
I mean, just to say, you know, this syringe sounds like a very small item in the big picture of rolling out vaccines. But we know very well, if you don't have syringes, you cannot put shots into people's arms. So it's a very important topic. There is a looming threat that syringe supplies will dry up.
The UN Children's Fund ships syringes for the global rollout of vaccines under the COVAX facility. Moeti says UNICEF predicts a global shortage of around 2 billion syringes needed for COVID-19 vaccine and routine immunizations.
Already some African countries like Kenya, Rwanda and South Africa have experienced delays in receiving vaccines. And unless drastic measures are taken to boost syringe production, Africa faces a crisis.
On a brighter note, Moeti says she's very excited by an announcement from pharmaceutical giant Merck that it will allow other drug makers to produce its new oral antiviral COVID-19 medicine.
Could this be a game changer? We sincerely hope so. We sincerely hope in the context of a global crisis of this nature and looking at the gaps in access and the needs and just the principle of local production, learning from the extremely difficult experience of this pandemic, that more and more pharmaceutical companies would exceptionally be willing to follow Merck's example.
Moeti notes local production of the drug and other COVID-19 therapeutics would help speed up and address inequity and access to key products in poorer nations. She says it would be extremely desirable to have similar patent sharing agreements extended to vaccine production as well. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in other news, President Joe Biden is calling on Sudan's military leaders to release detainees immediately and restore institutions of its deposed transitional government. It is Biden's first official statement on the crisis in Sudan since the military announced its takeover early this week. Biden said in a statement issued shortly after he left Washington for a G20 meeting in Rome that, quote, "The events of recent days are a grave setback, but the United States will continue to stand with the people of Sudan and their nonviolent struggle to advance the goals of Sudan's revolution." For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com and remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. As world leaders prepare to meet at the COP26 next week, environmental activists are calling on them to recognize that climate change is a threat multiplier that worsens existing political and economic threats while creating new ones like food and water insecurity. Consequently, the competition over fewer resources contributes to conflict and displacement in societies around the world. A new animation film, Footsteps on the Wind, explores the difficult reality of climate change refugees around the world through the eyes of children. Filmmaker Maya Sandbar highlights the plight of child refugees whose communities are torn apart due to extreme weather and food insecurity, forcing them to leave their homes. She joins me from her home in London to talk about the film.
So Maya, why don't you tell us a little bit about this film and how the issues of climate change and refugees are related?
The film is called Footsteps on the Wind, and as the title indicates, it's about how we mark our planet and the steps that we take along our journeys. And it's on the wind because we all affect our lives, both from a climate point of view as individuals, but also related to the refugee story and how they walk aimlessly, you know, finding a new home. The refugees that are very core to the central story of the film are refugees because of climate change, but also because of conflict, because of poverty. There's many reasons why you'd be displaced. And the song was written by Sting in 2016 in reaction to the Syrian crisis and seeing kids washed up on the shore. We've all seen these images that are quite shocking. And, you know, he's also very involved with the climate discussion. And it was really important to us to make sure that it addresses all kinds of displacement and refugees in that sense.
Now, Maya, leaving home can be quite a traumatic experience. For whatever reason, if you're forced out of your home, whether you're an adult or a child, but more so, I believe, as a child, that can be quite traumatic. Why did you choose to explore this topic through the eyes of children?
Well, first of all, for your first point about children, it was really important to tell the story from a child's point of view because there are so many unaccompanied children in the world that people don't talk about. You know, in Calais, when some of the camps shut down, vans come up and children disappear. Children also lose education. They lose opportunities through these journeys. And whether they're accompanied or unaccompanied, it's important to tell that story from their point of view. And animation came in because it was a way of accessing the emotion side of the journey rather than the factual newsy side of the story that we all see. Like, we see reports on the evening news and the idea with this film was in a bite-sized 7 minutes to access the emotional aspects of the journey and how your life can be shattered from a happy home. Usually you would never leave your home willingly. It's something that pushes you away to leave the home. And then the earthquake at the beginning is very much a metaphor for anything that shakes up your life. And animation was a way to access the emotions and access them in a beautiful way and in a way that was artistic, because art has a way of accessing emotion in a very quick way, because we don't have a lot of time to tell the story. You know, it's a big responsibility that we felt as a team to tell the story of, you know, 8 million people who are, you know, refugees on the planet at the moment, and how do you encompass that into one story that's 7 minutes? And these two children, a little boy and a little girl, who represent a little bit this whole population. We researched the story from, you know, what we found, but also, I mean, I have a background of refugees in my family, but we did a lot of research of what's happening today, but also did workshops with refugees themselves in London and in the US. And when we worked with them, we realized that the stories that they were telling us were traumatic and terrible, but when we asked them to draw their experiences, they used a lot of color and a lot of beauty in the way that they talked about their stories, and a lot of metaphors when it came to, you know, a panda and a bird that's going to fly over.
For those who haven't watched it yet, the legendary Sting provides, I guess, a soundtrack to the movie. How did you get Sting to be involved, and what's the love of his involvement in this project?
Well, Sting wrote the song, and when I heard it, I asked him, would you donate the song to us for us to make this film? I've been wanting to make a film about refugees for a while. And he said, yeah, go for it. You know, we're really happy for the song to be used. And Sting is someone who does a lot of things from the heart. And when he wrote the song, I happened to be around, you know, when he was, you know, in his studio, and he, you know, he was wondering about how to pronounce the word. He was trying different ways of saying the word inshallah. There's a big responsibility. This is a big word in Arabic, and because I speak Arabic, it was nice to listen in on it. And he pronounced it so beautifully in his own way, and he was really sensitive about how it would be perceived. You know, can anyone own this word? Does it certain only the Arabic speaking countries own this word, or can anyone own it? And
he was worried about being labeled as a cultural appropriator.
Yeah. And I was really touched by that, because I thought that was really sensitive to even wonder about that.
We're quite sensitive. Many people have these blind spots towards that type of...
Yeah.
That was filmmaker Maya Sanba speaking to me from her home in London. Voice of America! In 2013, the super typhoon Haiyan hit the Philippines, which was considered as one of the most powerful tropical typhoons ever recorded on Earth. And now, experts don't deny the possibility that another super typhoon could pass through the country this year or the coming years. As Stanley Gayete reports from Manila, environmental activists are now worried that the Philippine government is not paying serious attention to the issue of climate change.
In Singapore, the tiny island experienced heavy rainfall, soaking one part of a month's rainfall for a single day. From southern United States to central China and western Europe, record-level floods had inundated cities, killing hundreds of leaving behind millions of dollars of destruction. In other parts of the world, drought threatened millions to go hungry as the world's climate took a revenge on man's neglect and abuse, warming the seas to bring powerful cyclones. The Philippines experienced firsthand in 2013 when Super Typhoon Haiyan, locally known as Yolanda, struck in the country's belly, killing more than 7,000 people and leaving 200,000 households homeless. But the country has not seen the end of it. In fact, the Weather Bureau warned more powerful and destructive typhoons in the months ahead.
Hindi po natin...
According to the Philippines Weather Bureau, they are not ignoring the possibility of having another super typhoon in the country, because historically, that kind of typhoon is really forming through time. And that's why the Philippines should always prepare, because anytime it could happen. Climate change experts believe human activities contributed a lot to global warming and to the unpredictable weather conditions across the world. Human mobility and activity slowed down from last year after the coronavirus outbreak, giving Mother Earth a break. But experts said the pandemic has worsened pollution and continued to endanger the world.
So mas malaki po yung contribution.
The Weather Bureau said the anthropogenic or man-made greenhouse gases largely contribute to climate change, and evaluating the weather patterns this time of the new normal is critical. As people stayed at their homes, new businesses blossomed, driven by online shopping and food delivery, but created a new problem: plastics. There was overproduction and consumption of plastics. Plastic packaging, face masks, and face shields are choking river systems and the seas, worse than pre-pandemic levels.
Walang strict regulations.
EcoWaste Coalition Aileen Lucero said the Philippines has no strict regulations when it comes to controlling pollution, as large multi-layered packaging materials production is in the Philippines. She also said that pollution worsened this time of COVID-19 pandemic because of popular online delivery anywhere, as the ratio multiplied by the population in a city is increasing. The Duterte government appeared not worried about the plastic problem and climate change, allocating only 165 million pesos or $3.3 million for the Climate Change Commission's budget this year. It is small compared to most agencies, and experts questioning the government's commitment to cut down carbon emissions to help achieve the global target. Experts said at the end of the pandemic, thrashes are there, including plastics, and there are no other disposal areas available. They are also worried because the Philippines is at the forefront of typhoons in Asia. Because of this, environment experts advise the government to prepare for another Yolanda-like typhoon and take measures to live up to its Paris 2015 commitment to limit global warming below 2 degrees Celsius before it's too late. Aileen Lucero of EcoWaste Coalition explained that it is needed to have a national comprehensive ban on single use of plastics. She also added that cleanup drives are not the solution and there's a need for systemic change. Let's accept the fact that climate change is here and we cannot reverse anymore the environmental effects of it. But just like many experts said, what we can only do now is to slow down its impact. The question is, do you have enough programs and policies to address climate change? How will the next country leader handle this serious environmental issue? For VOA News, I am Stanley Buenafuegete in Manila, Philippines.
Voice of America!
In Lebanon, the parliament voted this week to hold legislative elections in March of 2022. The legislators also reconfirmed the right of Lebanese in the diaspora to vote for their members of parliament. George Eid reports for VOA from Beirut.
The Lebanese parliament confirmed on Thursday its approval to hold early elections in the country next year, despite a request from the Lebanese president, Michel Aoun, to reconsider. A vote on allowing the government to hold the parliamentary elections on March 27 instead of May 8 was backed by 77 of the legislators' 116 sitting members. Political and local journalist Gabi Mrad considers the amendments approved by the parliament insufficient.
He says that what happened today in the parliament confirms once again that political rivalry affects how laws are being made in parliament, and this is something unacceptable. We can see that some people don't want the elections to happen, and others don't want the experts to vote. They did not approve all the amendments needed to make it a modern and more representative law.
Parliament also endorsed an amendment to grant Lebanese expatriates the right to vote for representatives in their home districts. Although, according to the current law, non-resident Lebanese citizens only vote for 6 additional MP seats in the 2022 elections. Caroline Khalifi Shamas, a Lebanese expat living in Dubai, says that 500,000 Lebanese expats should vote in order to impose a real change in the upcoming elections.
So if each and every person outside of Lebanon decides to get involved, decide to register, decides to vote, we are able to create and have members of the parliament, ministers, a president who resembles us, who wants what's best for Lebanon. We need to vote. We need to change this reality that we're living in.
Leticia Campbell, a Lebanese expat who lives in Dubai, says she is hoping to change the current political ruling parties in the upcoming elections.
This is my duty as a Lebanese woman to strive for change and a better future for Lebanon. This vote may contribute to legally and professionally in my dream for a better Lebanon, for me, my family, and my friends.
In a country devastated by a major economic crisis, many Lebanese are looking forward to the elections in order to initiate the much-needed change that would restore economic order and stability to the country. This is George Aid, reporting for VOA from Beirut.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening.
Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.